Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors. Asking the questions no one else asks. Creating solutions no one else can. Because achieving your success is how Bloom Shapiro measures theirs. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Larry Rifkin along with John Kropczyk. And John, the issue of peer pressure, I don't know if you're sensing it during this coronavirus situation, but of course we look around and we see who's wearing gloves, who's wearing masks, and now it's not even a matter of personal choice, it's required. But people do look at someone next to them if they're not wearing a mask, and they say, wait a minute, pal, that's to protect me from you, not to protect you from me necessarily, so why aren't you wearing it too? Because we are all spreaders. I mean, I hate to think about it, but we're all the disease carriers.
Yeah, well, I think the mask is important, and I do. You do look at people, but I think there's some crazy stuff going on, like in the food store. You know, there are people that just don't know how to follow the arrows.
Oh.
But then you got the people who are the policemen who are real obnoxious about it, you know, which, I don't know. I mean, I, like I said, I don't know if people are doing it to be against it or they're just, they don't know, but. I just hate those people who are the policemen who really.
Well, I haven't really seen that.
I've seen it at a couple of stores.
I'm really impressed, though. I mean, as much as we have so many divides in America, if you look at the statistics, about 84% of the people say, yeah, we should do that. We should wear a mask.
Yep.
We should socially distance. So even while there's some divides that certain people are seeing, people are using their noggin and they're saying, hey, I want to protect you. I care about you. And realizing that none of us know how this thing really gets transmitted. We hear about it. Sometimes they take one of those indicators off the list, then they add another one. But we know that it's something through the mouth and the nose, and so everybody's being very, very careful. And that is an example, John, of what we're going to talk about in this podcast. It's called Under the Influence, the book, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. Now, how appropriate is it at this moment in time that we're seeing a classic example of that?
Yeah, well, you think about it, and it's good because even if this virus goes away, we still have the flu every year, and we got to protect older people. So we got to really continue these practices up,
yeah,
you know,
I mean,
to protect the elderly.
And when you look at it, John, think about all the social behaviors that have changed, not because of laws and regulations, but because over time, for example, smoking, John, probably the best example we can come to. Over time, you became something of an outsider if you began to smoke because people said, I don't want that around me. Now,
right.
A lot of it was the secondhand smoke concept,
right.
But nonetheless, people began to look at you differently. And it really depended on who your social circle was as to whether you were still smoking. And if you were in a circle that wasn't, you'd likely try it a lot harder, even as it relates to drunken driving. I mean, we're going to take your keys away because the society, individually, one by one, started talking to each other and saying, hey, this doesn't make any sense. These people should not be allowed in a bar until 2 a.m. and then allowed to drive home because they're a danger to the rest of us. So I think it's really fascinating to see the impact that we have on each other. Now, I want to bring you into this because I know for some period of time you were thinking of putting solar panels up. And I think we are impressed by our neighbors. We look around and we say, wow, I wonder what he's saving or she's saving. And then you ask them and they tell you. So, John, when you looked at it, what was it that was part of the equation as you thought about that?
Well, you know, I like solar panels. I'd like to get them because they save electricity, let's face it. And, you know, your electric bill is lower, which makes me happy. The only bad part about those, and the only thing that's kind of stopping me now is you sign into a contract for like 25 years for these panels. And I don't know, to me, that's just too long for something electronic like that. I find it, you know.
Well, you're in the electronics game, so you understand that. But over time, as it changes, we're likely to see virtually every roof in America have solar panels.
And they should.
Yeah, one by one. But even buying electric cars, smaller homes as opposed to larger homes. I mean, whatever people were doing, I remember in the 90s, John, when I built our home, everybody was building these little McMansions.
Yes.
There was just something about that moment in time, and everybody had a really nice foreign car. I've never done that. I've been very practical when it comes to my cars. But we're all influenced by each other. We're under the influence, the spell of one another. Well, Robert H. Frank and I have a very frank conversation about it today on America Trends.
With me on the line on America Trends is Robert H. Frank, and he is a professor of management and a professor of economics at Cornell University's Johnson Graduate School of Management. He also has been an Economic View columnist for the New York Times for more than a decade, and he's got this fascinating book called Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. Now, I might think that you are a sociologist, based on the way that you are looking at trends in our society in terms of the movement on policy issues. Have any other sociologists said, hey, why is an economist getting into this notion of behavioral contagion?
Yeah, I'm sometimes mistaken for a sociologist. That's true. In fact, Elizabeth Warren, in one of her pieces that she wrote, quoted me as saying something and described me as the sociologist Robert Frank. and many economists would be insulted by being called a sociologist. I don't take that as an insult at all. I think our aim is to figure out what people are up to, and economists have something useful to say about that, but so do sociologists.
Well, remind us about your basic premise. I mean, what motivates human behavior? And let me just take a particular case in point, because you do, focus on it a bit in the book, and that is same-sex marriage. And I've got to tell you, when I go back and you look at the numbers, you know, years ago, when I think about the thing that perhaps my father, who died in 1971, and he was a very open-minded person, but one thing he probably could never have imagined if he came back and asked me what's new, is same-sex marriage, and how quickly that issue moved. Even when in 2009, I believe it was, Barack Obama said he was publicly against it. How did it move so quickly?
You know, it's a complicated world out there, and we don't come into it fully equipped with a list of things that we should believe and shouldn't. And so I think it's quite natural for us to take cues from other people about what our beliefs ought to be. So if you think, for example, about slavery, if you talk to people my kids' age, they would all know that they were firmly against slavery, but I don't think they or their friends could reproduce in any detail the arguments that were used for and against the idea of slavery when the actual debate was taking place hundreds of years ago, in some cases, more recently in others. It's that they think slavery is unacceptable because everybody they know thinks it's unacceptable. And I think it's similar with other sensitive beliefs. In must have been 1989, we saw an article by Andrew Sullivan, a very well-reasoned article, why it would make sense for the community to allow people to marry whomever they chose the same benefits of heterosexual marriage would redound to the community if we also permitted people who wanted to marry somebody of the same sex to do so. But at that time, only about one person in 10 thought it was okay to do that. As more and more people change their minds, you seem less and less like somebody who was unmoored from his senses if you said, yeah, why shouldn't we allow that? And then it picked up steam. And you mentioned Barack Obama, also Hillary Clinton in late 2008, both came out against same-sex marriage, which was on the ballot in California about to be voted on. In 2015, of course, the Supreme Court said that it was legal in every state. Now 70% of people all across the country say, yeah, what's the problem?
Well, how did that continue? Because you did have political leaders and progressive ones at the time saying, no, I don't think we're ready for it as a society. So how do people, individuals, you talk about proximity to individuals whom you care about who are gay and saying that that is really important. If you don't know anyone who is and you don't think it's an issue to be worried about, maybe it's something that you wouldn't agree is necessary, particularly when political leadership on both sides was not moving the issue at warp speed by any means.
Yeah, it seemed to be a whole combination of things. Nate Silver has written about it. He grew up gay and in East Lansing, Michigan, was closeted until I don't know what age, but he said it was just not possible to be an out person at that time. But more and more people were coming out. Prominent people had a son or daughter who was gay. They talked about it in the media. And, once it became clear that people who enjoyed positions of high respect in the community were beginning to say publicly, yeah, why shouldn't we allow this? Then it became suddenly less risky to voice that view. And we saw a similar thing in the fall of the Soviet bloc countries. You know, there were cranks who had predicted that they would dissolve every year for 20 years, but it never happened. Then in the late 80s, it did happen. No pundits of any serious reputation predicted it would happen then. Why did it happen suddenly? Well, it's very hard to say, except that if you understand behavioral contagion, you know that things like that are just inherently hard to predict, that once they acquire a little push, you can see them opinions changing like a row of dominoes falling. You know, it's dangerous to speak out against an oppressive regime. Some people will do it no matter what anyway, but most people won't. If there's a slight shift, if somebody who wouldn't have spoken out before now is outraged by something and starts speaking out, maybe that raises the proportion of people speaking out just enough so that the next most sensitive person, it's crossed his threshold too, he speaks out, and then you get just a prairie fire ensues. And that seems to be what happened. We still can't predict when stuff like that will happen very much, but we shouldn't pretend to be surprised that it can happen that way.
Well, I remember the saying, and I think it was attributed to Mao, that sometimes nothing happens for decades, and then at other times decades happen overnight. And I think that's a really interesting concept. For example, I keep waiting for a headline that says America's bankrupt. With all of the debt and all the obligations that we have, tacked on. And I still imagine one day that I will see that headline, but no one's predicting that today by any means. But let me go back to the environment in which we exist. We used to have networks that were very centralized, and they would give us the information that we would attain. Now we have all kinds of influencers and information coming from outside sources, people who become their own seers on social media. And so that would suggest that there's a lot of ability for behavioral contagion because we have such a great device or megaphone for distributing it. On the other hand, we're so divided as a nation. Every action or every behavior is met with someone else's behavior in the opposite direction. So help us with those various polarities that are going on.
Yeah, it is a challenging moment, that's for sure. And the technology clearly matters. There was a study that assigned people to follow people from the opposite political party, prominent people on Twitter. And they did surveys of their opinions, the participants in this experiment, both before and after some months of following people from the opposing camp. And it turned out that for conservatives to follow prominent liberals on Twitter caused them to hold their own conservative positions more forcefully after some months. There was a slight effect in the same direction for liberals, but it was not statistically significant. So, just merely being isolated from other people doesn't seem to explain why we have trouble making contact with them. Every time Al Gore would announce a new discouraging study in the warming literature, that would seem to harden the resistance of climate deniers to taking any meaningful mitigation steps in climate policy. So yeah, that's hugely a challenge. With the technology we have, though, ideas can spread more quickly and forcefully than they used to be able to. So a nice example of that is that the Me Too movement, which was launched by a tweet bearing the hashtag Me Too accompaniment in 2017, almost overnight generated millions of people very, very deeply involved in the conversation, and the public attitude toward harassment in the workplace and elsewhere and tolerance of misbehavior in that dimension seemed to change very rapidly, almost overnight. There had been 10 years earlier an attempt to launch exactly the same movement. It was called even the Me Too movement. That attempt went nowhere because in 2007 there simply wasn't the device called a Twitter hashtag that could enable people who were interested in an issue to find one another and exchange stories with one another. So the technology clearly does matter. And also we're starting to learn more about how better to make contact with people who don't agree with you. And the first lesson concerns how not to do harm. I mentioned people hearing Gore make a pronouncement and that hardening their opposition to whatever it was he believed. You very rarely make progress trying to get somebody to embrace your opposing point of view. The times when progress happens, researchers have discovered in these conversations, are when people just engage with one another and listen to each other's point of view. And in those conversations, what really seems to make a difference is to pose the right question. So learning theorists have known for a long time that if you try to explain a concept to a student, it often takes some resistance and doesn't sink in very well. If you can somehow contrive to lead the student to discover the concept on her own, then miraculously it just gets embedded much more quickly and deeply into the brain. It's a very robust finding. And so asking the right question has that effect. It gets people to think about something in a way they hadn't before. And so a very powerful example in my own experience was in a book I wrote a few years ago about the role of luck in life. It turned out that if you tried to tell people who were successful that they had been lucky along the way, as indeed Barack Obama did in a speech in 2012, business owners should remember that they shipped their goods to market on public roads, that they hired workers, the community helped educate, that they were protected by police and firefighters who were hired by the community. Their obligation was to pay forward and help others in the next round succeed like they did. People didn't hear that message at all. It was a totally sensible message, but what they heard apparently was that Obama was telling them that they didn't deserve the success they'd earned, that they were entitled to the lofty positions they held, what I discovered was that if you just ask a successful person whether he can remember any examples of lucky breaks he enjoyed along the way to the top, they don't get angry at hearing that question. They don't get defensive in any way. They take interest right away in thinking about it. You can see their eyes light up when they think of an example. Quickly, they tell you about it, kindles the memory of a second example. They tell you about that too. And then all by themselves, they're asking, why aren't we investing more in the schools? Why aren't we investing more in infrastructure? So ask, don't tell. That's the name of the last chapter in the book, actually. And it tries to summarize some of what we learned about how to make more effective contact when people don't initially agree in their conversations.
It's fascinating because I'm wondering in our conversation, because the subtitle to your book is Putting Peer Pressure to Work. And I'm just wondering what role leadership takes, because you mentioned the Me Too movement. When I think about the Tea Party movement, I can't name one leader involved in that. You talk a lot about climate change and trying to put peer pressure into the equation. And yet perhaps because it wasn't a scientist who led us to a greater understanding and concern for the issue, but a politician, half of the people in America who didn't like that politician's politics turned against it and wouldn't really join. But yet with the Tea Party or Me Too, I don't know who led those movements. And there are
others that's a good point.
Similar to that, Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, that's a great point. So where the point of view that's out there came from initially is potentially very important in how people react to it. If it comes from an identifiable source in the other tribe, then it's pushing a stone uphill, and much better, as you point out, if it comes from I don't know where.
Nobody knows where. Robert Brooks is with us, Under the Influence. Let's talk about smoking, because I think people can understand this. I mean, just the sea change about smoking. Now, you talk about the externalities. You talk about the sense that if the most important thing is not necessarily about secondhand smoke or even taxation today, which, people say, well, we're going to penalize you if you smoke. It's really about who you hang around with and who in your social context actually smokes, and whether that has become something of an anathema to people as opposed to something that was socially so accepted as a norm.
Right. Yeah, I think if you're a parent, if you have a teenage daughter, you're worried whether she's going to become a smoker, it doesn't help you at all to know that she's a science fiction fan or good in math or is a fan of the Boston Red Sox. None of that matters. What matters is how many of her friends smoke, and it's a big effect. If that percentage goes up from 20 to 30, she's 25% more likely to become or remain a smoker. The psychologists have always known about this general truth. The way they put it is it's the situation, not the person. So we see somebody do something, we try to explain, why did she do it? Well, the impulse is to ask what kind of person would do such a thing. So we think about traits of character and personality. But that's uninformative, generally, the psychologists say. They say you should really be focusing on the social forces that were surrounding the person when she decided what to do. And so that's really not controversial to say that the social environment has a huge influence on us. It's sometimes for ill, in the smoke example, for instance, but it's often for good. Information we get when we see other people confidently doing something. We don't know whether we should do it or not, but at least to have an impulse to say, well, they're doing it, and none of them individually knows more than I know, but collectively other people know way more than I do. Maybe I ought to at least investigate whether it would be in my interest to be doing that thing too. That's a good impulse in many situations. So what's so interesting to me is that we never really investigated the implications of the fact that the causation goes in both directions. So the social environment influences us, but we influence the social environment. It's just a consequence in the aggregate of the individual things we all do. And yet nobody, or at least very few people, worry that they should behave differently because of how what they do might affect the social environment. And if you're thinking to become a smoker, I don't know many people who say, oh, maybe I shouldn't do that. I'll make others more likely to smoke. But that's by far the biggest reason that society has an interest in your not becoming a smoker. Because if you do become one, you'll make many other people more likely to smoke. And that's an effect that we ought to be concerned about. If there's anything that we could do about it at acceptable cost, which I argue, of course, there are many things we could do about it.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers over 40 years of experience in a broad base of services from accounting and tax to cybersecurity, technology, and transaction advisory. Bloom's experts will maintain an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
Let me go to the issue of housing. When I grew up, it was very acceptable for all of us to live in small homes, maybe with one car, and we lived on postage stamp lots. And today, I live in a suburban area, and it's not a McMansion, but it's a larger home than I ever imagined living in. It's got an acre and so forth. Tell us what we did here as a society, ramping up and changing our expectations.
Yeah, that's one of the most important implications of behavioral contagion, is that what we spend, indeed what we need to spend in order to achieve basic goals, depends on what others around us spend. So the main change in the economy since about 1970 has been that most of the income growth has gone to people at the top of the income ladder. In the preceding decades, it wasn't like that at all. Incomes were growing at about the same, slightly less than 3% annual rate for people at the top, in the middle, all the way down to the bottom. That changed for interesting reasons. In about 1970, after that, most of the growth went to the top, and people at the top did what normal people at every level of income do when they get more income. They bought bigger and better. So the mansions at the top grew bigger, naturally. The people in the middle don't shake their fists in anger. They want to see pictures of the mansions. I'll be rich someday, they think. Probably they won't, but it's entertaining to see the footage and the images of the fancy things that rich people buy. And so there's no harm done there, obviously, but the people just below the top, they go to the wedding receptions that are now held in the homes of the people at the top. They used to be in country clubs or hotels. Now the biggest mansions have ballrooms. They can accommodate hundreds of guests. Now the people in the second rung, they need a bigger house because they travel in those circles, and yet they have to be able to entertain in a similar style. People just below them, now they need a dining room that accommodates 18, not 12, so they build bigger. And all the way down the ladder, now the house in the middle, the median house, is about 70%, 60% larger than its counterpart from when you were growing up. And if you don't buy what the person at your income level buys, and here's the real rub, we might say people in the middle are buying houses more expensive than they can afford, which is true. They're in debt. They're not saving nearly enough. They're borrowing way more than is prudent. But if you tell them, scale back, buy the house you can afford, here's the problem with that. To send your kid to a school of just average quality, if you're the earner in the middle, what must you do? You must buy the median priced house for your area. Why? Because good schools are always and everywhere in the more expensive neighborhood. So if your goal as a parent is just to send your kid to an average school, and I think we'd think ill of you as a parent if you weren't at least that ambitious, you've got to match what others like you are spending. And so it's been a huge burden on people in the middle. The fact that to achieve this thoroughly laudable goal to send your kid to a decent school, you've got to spend much more than you can comfortably afford on housing than families did 30 or 40 years ago.
Now, a really interesting example, because you brought up weddings and having them in these McMansions, but you also talk about destination weddings and the fact that a wedding that used to cost, and I had a very modest one by standards today, today could cost someone $100,000. And why people accept that or think that's what I have to aspire to instead of going down to City Hall. I mean, where did that all come from? And explain how that fits into this paradigm of contagion in terms of our social context and being under the influence.
Yeah, the narrative there is almost exactly parallel to the one that explains why people in the middle are buying so much more expensive and bigger houses than before. You know, the people at the top have more money. They spent more on their weddings. The people in the next group spent more, too. I'm guessing when you got married, you had never heard the term destination wedding.
Well, the destination was about 2 miles from my home.
Yeah. And it wasn't called a destination wedding, therefore. Now
it was called the last resort to many who knew the place I got married. I'm sorry. Yes.
People my kids' age, they have to go to weddings all over the world. Now some of my sons feel obligated to go to destination bachelor parties. You want to put on a celebration that acknowledges that you understand what a special occasion it is, and if others are spending more, you spend more. That's just the way. Of course, if you're really clever, you can stage a party that seems really fun to the guests and spend half what people like you spend on average. But look, that's not a strategy that's available to everyone. Half the people out there are less clever than average. You can exploit those edges only if you have some other edge yourself. For the rest, it's just a dilemma.
I would say that the issue of tattoos in our society, you know, it used to be that it was folks in the military and maybe some other folks at a lower socioeconomic level would get a tattoo, but most people would never get a tattoo. And look at what's happened and that change in our society. Does that have some, explanation that we can use to talk about your whole concept of social contagion?
You know, you want to be on fashion's cutting edge. This is just a familiar dynamic that we've seen in lots of other fashion-related examples. So I remember seeing back in junior high school, it was called then, the first time one of my classmates showed up at school in a skirt above the knee. It was a sensation around the school.
Scandalous.
Everybody was abuzz about it. And of course, other people quickly bought skirts an inch above the knee, and then nobody noticed much anymore until somebody looking for an edge bought a skirt 3 inches above the knee. And then the skirts went up and up. Finally, they reached a point where you think, well, they can't go up anymore. And indeed, at some point, we saw the midi skirt or the maxi skirt became the rage. So, yeah, to stand out in a fashion sense, you have to be different from what people expect. And if no one has a tattoo, then you can get a little one and suddenly everybody notices and that's cool and there's buzz. But what it takes to get attention with tattoos and piercings now is much more extreme. So I think we're seeing some evidence that the pendulum swing back the other way there, too. My two youngest sons are 33 and 30, and they are distinct from most of their peers in that neither one of them has even a single tattoo. I think they're on the cutting edge by virtue of that simple fact. So I think maybe we'll start seeing things swing there, too.
You have this concept in the book of the mother of all cognitive illusions, and you relate it to higher tax rates. Can you unpack that a bit for us?
we've got some serious problems to solve. Obviously, inequality is a big one, but the biggest one by far is the challenge posed by warming. I think most people, after a lot of resistance for several decades, have now accepted that it's a serious problem and that we need to do something about it. But there's no clear agreement on what we should do about it. I think there's an uneasy recognition that to actually deal with the crisis is going to be really expensive. I mean, I've heard engineers say it will take a mobilization akin to what we did in World War II, which in today's terms would be several $1 trillion a year invested in green and energy infrastructure and the like. That's a scary piece of news to land on many ears. And I think if we're going to raise that kind of money, where is it going to come from? We're not going to get it from taxing poor people or even middle-income people. It's got to come from taxes on people higher up in the income ladder. And those people have been very resistant to higher taxes. And I think the reason they've been resistant is that they think higher taxes would make it more difficult for them to buy the things they want. But that's the illusion. So you try to think about, suppose you're a wealthy person, you try to think about a proposal to raise your taxes to help pay for green energy infrastructure. How will that affect me? The natural strategy would be to think back to the last time your taxes went up. How did you feel about that? Well, it turns out that strategy doesn't work in the current environment because tax rates for people at the top have been falling steadily ever since World War II. The top rate then was 92%. It's 37% now, and it's been falling steadily with almost no exceptions all throughout the intervening decades. And so you can't think back to a time when your taxes went up significantly to know how that would affect you. So instead, you rely on what seems like the natural plan B of a cognitive strategy. You know that taxes going up means you'll have less money to spend, and so you just try to think about earlier times when you had less money to spend. And everybody can remember times like that. No matter how charmed your life has been, you had a losing lawsuit, you had a home fire, a health crisis, a bad business year, a divorce, all sorts of things. Every one of those memories is deeply negative. You don't want that anything like that to happen again. And so that's what you think you'd feel like if your taxes went up. But people don't realize, and it's totally natural that they wouldn't, is that those kinds of events are completely different from when your taxes go up. When those events happen, when you have a home fire, your income goes down. Everybody else's income in your circle stays the same as before. And so the things that you're trying to buy, the special extras that you care about, a penthouse apartment with a sweeping view, whatever it might be, those things are scarce. There aren't enough of them, so everybody gets one. How do you get them? You have to outbid people like you who want them. And when your income goes down because you paid higher taxes and people like you experience the same reduction in their incomes, your relative bidding power is exactly the same as it would have been if taxes had stayed the same. And so you really aren't forced to make any sacrifice when your taxes go up. Mm-hmm. We know.
That's much too logical for most people. Let me ask you, is all of this about the impulse to conform? In other words, when we see the herd going in one direction, we don't want to be left behind. We do want to be where our peers are. We don't want to look as if we stand out in any way. You do say that taking careful account of peer influences can lead to substantially better policy choices on the main. So is it that we as individuals grow, progress, our thinking changes often to the better, or the notion that history bends to a positive way? I mean, what is it that's going on here, the impulse to conform vis-a-vis better choices, once we see that conformity now is something that it wasn't in the past?
You know, the impulse to conform isn't mysterious. Other people collectively know a lot more than any one of us does. And so when we see people installing solar panels. It's totally normal and praiseworthy even to ask yourself, wow, what do they know that makes them decide to do that? Maybe I ought to investigate whether it makes sense for me to do that too. And we know that solar panel installation is extremely contagious. The best estimate we have is that one new installation in California, this was back in the early days of the installation process, would on average generate a new installation from a neighbor within 4 months. Each new installation, and the original one too, keeps generating another new installation then every 4 months. And so what you see as a pattern is that the first installation occurs, then 4 months later you have two, another 4 months later you have four. It doubles every 4 months. After 2 years, you've got 64 homes with solar panels just from neighbors copying one another's first move. And it's an enormously powerful and quick process when it happens. That can happen, too, with bad behavior. So I think the challenge for policymakers is to launch cascades of that sort when we know that the effect would be good and try to inhibit them when we know that the effect would be bad. And in the case of solar panels, we gave tax credits and other inducements to launch the process. But once it got launched, it had a life of its own. In the case of smoking, we claimed we needed to act because of secondhand smoke. Well, secondhand smoke is a problem, but it's a minuscule problem compared to the harm you do of making others more likely to smoke when you start smoking. And that's the real reason to intervene against smoking. And the taxes and the various restrictions we put on had some initial effect, but the main reason smoking rates fell so dramatically in the ensuing decades was that when some didn't start, others had fewer peers who were smoking, so they didn't start, and it radiated outward in a multiplicative fashion like that.
So let me ask you in closing, fascinating book, Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. Robert H. Frank has been our guest. So for policy makers and leaders, should they be looking at polls, or should they be driving around their neighborhood saying, gee, I see all these solar panels, let me try to make some policy that is going to be socially beneficial? People are recognizing this. I'm not going too far out on a limb here to say that more subsidies or more encouragement really is the way to get better results in our society. And, you know, what is it that you hope from a book like this that somebody who's reading it, who is a policymaker, will grab a hold of as a concept, how to use this peer pressure to induce good change in our society?
I describe it as just an unbelievable opportunity for us all. The venture capitalists have a term, they call it a green field. What they mean by that term is that there's suddenly a vast new set of investment opportunities opened up and people are rushing to take advantage of them. So when the iPhone was introduced in 2007, all of a sudden there were scores of products and services that couldn't have existed before the iPhone was introduced, which were now possible, and then investors were racing to bring them to market. It's analogous in the policy domain. Once we recognize how important the social environment is as a determinant of what we do as individuals, and that sometimes it has a good effect on us, other times it has a perverse effect on us, then we can think about incentives to behave in ways that foster better social environments, or little sticks we can put in people's paths that get them to behave in other ways that discourage the formation of harmful social environments. I think you don't want to have meddlesome bureaucrats trying to micromanage every aspect of our lives, but we have to tax something anyway, so why not tax those behaviors that cause other people to suffer injury when doing that not only reduces the amount of injury they suffer, but also generates revenue that enables us to reduce taxes on useful activities. We tax payrolls now. why should we do that? That discourages firms from hiring more workers. We shouldn't be taxing payrolls. Every time we tax a harmful activity, one that contributes to a harmful social environment, we could be reducing the tax on a good activity.
Very interesting. Robert H. Frank, I can't thank you enough for sharing these ideas and getting people thinking about how change really occurs in our society and what our individual role and place in that new order may be. Thanks for joining us today on the America Trends podcast.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR network. MHNRnetwork.com. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes Bloom different.